Thank you. Now we are in this study in Corinthians, and we've come to Corinthians chapter 13. Corinthians is chock full of advice for the troubled church, and as such is a good study for any church. Troubles are inevitable, but this chapter 13 reminds me of when I used to walk to school every day, and that's been a few years ago now, but one day I was walking to school and it was wet and muddy, and on the sidewalk I found a $20 bill. Now, for me, when I was, you know, maybe 14, 15 years old, a $20 bill would be like finding a $500 bill now. And so that's like this chapter 13. So you go through the advice, and Paul is saying, I can't praise you for this, and don't do that anymore, and pay attention over here. And then all of a sudden, we get into this chapter 13. And so I want to read verse 4 in your hearing now. Love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant. So what is this Greek term we're trying to learn, Christian love, rare in ancient Greek literature, but common in our New Testament? If you ask five different people what Christian love meant, you probably get five different answers. If you ask 50 different people, for an example, you probably get 50 different replies. This time of year, they have things like coat drives. They have things like gloves, trying to get the unfortunate ready for winter. So, you know, you get meals being handed out at Thanksgiving time. You got the Salvation Army out there doing this work. You got Samaritan's Purse out there doing this work. We have shoeboxes that went out filled with stuff headed for third world countries, which probably would be the only Christmas for these children that they get at all. And so here in our local church, the phone will ring from time to time, and someone will say, I don't have gas, I got to go to Buffalo. Or they'll say, I don't have any Thanksgiving dinner for my family. Or you get other requests. And there's an expectation there. And the expectation is the church, okay, that goes out and works in the name of God, is going to show compassion to this person with a request, whatever it might be. Now, some people teach that a component of love is acceptance of any and all lifestyle, and that acceptance should include celebration, affirmation of sometimes sinful lifestyles. We don't do that. Now, we have to be careful to preach salvation first and foremost, but we can't celebrate sinful lifestyles. That's indulgence rather than love. Those who are living in sin need to hear the gospel. And once saved, the Holy Spirit will guide them. And you will find that they come out of some of the habits and associations that they had before. But if we preach peace and safety, we're watchmen on the walls and aren't doing our job. we've become false prophets then. So verse 4 tells us love is patient, kind, not jealous, does not brag, and is not arrogant. In the original language, these qualities are verbs. So they should be seen as action. These are active qualities. It's not always possible to translate that into the English. Patient. I'm going to go over each one of these. The practice of love is patient, and I think that's probably the most needed element in love. It's an important virtue for Christian people. The literal translation, long-tempered. Have you ever associated with someone that had a short temper, short fuse? I have. You tend to be very careful around those people. Now, in our New Testament, the word is generally used in association with people rather than events. So you're patient with people. This word in the virtue is countercultural at the time this was written. In the Greek culture, patience was considered as a great weakness. And I have seen that when you try to be nice, people sometimes assume that you have a complete lack of assertiveness. You won't stand up for your rights if you try to be nice. It's a tremendous balancing act to try to be nice, but yet steer a course kind of down the middle. Aristotle said that it was an outstanding Greek virtue that they wouldn't tolerate any kind of a slight or an insult, but would retaliate. So rather, if you slap them on one cheek rather than turn the cheek, they give you two slaps back. That was their mindset. In an Asian country, you might call it saving face. Okay. In America, we might say the person has a short fuse. And this is true in many cultures around the world. Now, today, if you look at the street culture, which is alive and well in every big city in this country, if you, quote, disrespect somebody, then you might well get shot. And so you see the total intolerance for any kind of an insult or a personal slight, and that is considered to be a good thing in those cultures. But if you set about to care for people, you have to learn patience. Why? People with problems very often have created their own problems. The other day when I was speaking, I said a man might bewail his life and he says he's in prison. Well, he doesn't recognize his signature on every brick in his cell. His choices got him where he is. Could be sinful lifestyles, could be substance abuse. Could be some kind of a personality disorder. There's any number of problems that plague people. Now, this isn't to say that they don't suffer, because they do. They might very well suffer. They might be in a hell of their own making. But the solutions could well be self-evident. Okay, so if you have somebody who has credit card people calling them every day because they're behind in the bills, the solution might be they have to pay those cards down and get on a budget and stop spending. But they can't do it. They can't seem to do it. Because The solution is out there, but they don't seem to be able to take hold of it. Or they don't want to take hold of it. And they continue to suffer with the particular problem. But the problem, okay, the credit card spender, the Amazon junkie, the person that just can't stop. The problem is not the phone calls driving them crazy. The problem is the habit of spending that they can't seem to stop. Some people have flaws in their personality. Some people have some mental issues or some kind of sin issue that might be the root of difficulties. But these things are preventing them from reaching out and taking hold of the solution. And if you set about to help them, you might see the solution just as clear as a nose on your face. But the problem is the person you're setting about to help can't seem to do it. You can help them from time to time. But it feels like you can never solve the basic problem because either they can't solve it themselves or they don't want to. I think counseling is the hardest task of all times when you're trying to guide somebody out of destructive behavior that's hurting them. And they feel the pain of the hurt, but they can't seem to get rid of the destructive behavior. They can't seem to come away from it. Patience. So if you're picking up somebody that has fallen 50 times and you help them number 51, it takes patience. It's not easy. And so you might ask, will patience cause you to be taken advantage of? The answer is yes. Yes, it will. You may be taken advantage of by someone who knows or assumes you have patience. Well, he's helped me before, she's helped me before, maybe they'll do it again. So the church gets calls from people that are asking for things from time to time. As I've said before, they might have a story about needing gas for their car, or they might say, well, I got no gifts for my children to put under the Christmas tree. So are they preying on the patience of a Christian church? The answer is yes. But we still pursue patience. The ultimate example of patience is God, who holds his hands out to rebellious people. And because he has been patient with us, we endeavor to be patient with others. That's what we do. Kind. Being kind kind of goes hand in hand with patience. So patience can define what you're going to put up with from others, and kindness defines what you're going to give to them. What will you give? What will you do? Our desire is to overcome evil with good. Remember, kindness doesn't happen by chance. It's a choice. It's a lifestyle. It's an intention. Okay? Because if you practice kindness, you purpose to be kind. That's your plan. Then you go out and do it. Kindness is deliberate and spontaneous. Okay? And so we might plan in advance some kind of deed that's kind. If you're going to bring somebody a meal, first you've got to get the groceries, then you've got to cook the meal, and then you've got to go deliver it. So that takes some intention. So if you're going to go and visit somebody, you might say, well, tomorrow we'll go and visit this one or that one. Or you might say, well, tomorrow we're going to go do this chore for this person that's physically not able to do it. That all is intentional. It's deliberate. Spontaneous kindness would be something like stopping and helping someone along the road, you know, be like the Good Samaritan. So you might stumble onto somebody that has some kind of need. You might stop and change a tire, you know, and you just hope that the person you're helping, number one, has a spare tire, and number two, has a jack that works. Those things are great contributors to being able to do it. That kindness flows from the need of the moment. So you become a neighbor to this chance-met stranger that you'll probably never meet again. And you do it because you have the desire and the intention to be kind. So kindness is both close and far away. Now, most of our kindness is going to be lavished on people that are close, people that we know, people we have interaction with, simply because if they have a need, we're most likely to know it. But also could be far away if you stop and help somebody that you've never met before. And I think most of us have done that at one time or another. But kindness can also be a solution for conflict. If we have an issue with another person, in Proverbs it says, a soft answer turneth away wrath. And so if someone says something sharp to you, immediately there's a choice. Are you going to give on a reply just as sharp or sharper? Or will you try to defuse the situation? We can decide to enter into conflict, or as Paul says, when abused, what? We conciliate. We try to be kind. And the kindness then is going to rule the situation. And perhaps you walk away from a conflict that might end up in sharp words or even fall to blows. Not jealous. Text switches here from telling us what love is to telling us what it is not. It's not jealous. Jealousy causes a lot of strife. So if you want to look at the very basics of jealousy, okay, look at two small children and the one small child comes in to visit and picks up a toy that child number one wasn't interested in any way, shape, or form. What happens? Child number one says, that's mine. And so takes it away from the visiting child, but then the visiting child picks up another toy. That's mine. And so you see human nature of jealousy at work. And one of the basics of jealousy is, I want what this other person has. Doesn't matter if I have enough, doesn't matter if I have something else, I want what they have. And so, jealousy. Jealousy stirs up a lot of trouble, can stir up trouble in the church. Okay, I want to do that project, or I want this thing done my way, or this person is doing it and I think I should be in charge. Love is not jealous. Sometimes jealousy can even go so far that we wish a person we're jealous of to come to harm. I wish that person would get in trouble. Or jealousy causes us to be happy when some person we're jealous of falls into harm. Now, the root of that word has a meaning of a strong desire. Okay, and an example is in the first chapter of Philippians, Paul's in prison, and he says, there are people out there preaching the gospel out of jealousy or out of envy. He can't be out preaching. And so he's got some others, very possibly he trained them. But they're jealous of his status, so they're out there preaching, trying to make a name for themselves. What does Paul say? He says, I don't care if they're preaching out of jealousy. I don't care if they're preaching out of love. I am very happy because what? The gospel is being preached. No matter what the motive of the preacher is. So Paul is not returning envy for envy. He's looking at the big picture and he says, I'm hoping that this preaching is going to do good out here. He rejoiced. He said, gospel's being preached. In Matthew chapter 20, we have the parable of the workers in the vineyard. And the owner goes out at the crack of dawn. He hires a bunch of men to work in the vineyard. And they agreed with him for a denarius. That was a Roman silver coin. I got one on my dresser. I bought it on the street in Jerusalem. But that was a day's wages at that time. So that would be enough for a man to eat and his family for a day. And so, but he goes out later, and there's more men standing around. He says, why aren't you working? He said, nobody hired us. He says, well, you come, and I'll do what's fair. They went in faith that the owner would be fair. And finally, he went out. It was like 4 p.m. or such a matter. And there was men still standing there. They said, what? You're not working? They said, no one hired us. He said, well, come, and I'll do what's fair. And when he paid them, he started with these hour workers. He paid them first, and he gave them a denarius. He gave them a full day's wages so they could eat that day. And as he went through and paid everybody, came finally the guys that worked all day, probably 10 hours. He gave them a denarius. They said, wait a minute, we should get more. We should get more. And he says, why is your eye evil because I'm generous? You agreed for a denarius. Take what's yours and go. Now, the evil eye, that was a first century idiom in the Hebrew or Aramaic. And it meant the greedy eye, the covetous eye, the eye that wants what somebody else has. Okay? So that's where we get into the translation theories of how literal do you want to get versus do you want to instead be more towards a commentary and try to bring out the English meaning of the Hebrew idiom. Anyway, the envious eye. And that is what? One that wants what somebody else has. So if I work 10 hours and he worked 1 hour, he got a denarius, then I should get 10 denarii, right? But the owner says, why is your eye evil? Why are you envious if I want to be generous? Don't you know this guy's got to eat just like you do? And so love is not jealous. The first murder recorded in Scripture was Abel by his brother Cain. The root cause? Jealousy. God had regard to his offering and did not have regard for Cain's. Jealousy caused Joseph to be sold as a slave by his brothers down into Egypt. They didn't like his dreams, and they didn't like his coat of many colors. Jealousy caused Daniel to be put in a lion's den with the other wise men of the day who were jealous of his status. And I can truthfully tell you that jealousy is alive and well to this day. I've seen it at work. In actual politics or office politics, which are sometimes more brutal than actual politics. But James has advice. He says, who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above. Okay, so he's talking the idea of jealousy and ambition. Okay, and he's speaking of godly traits. He says, wait a minute. That doesn't come from there. It's earthy. It's natural. It's demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder and every evil thing. Look out at our political landscape today. I don't like to talk a lot about politics, but if you look at all some of the negative ads that are out there and also some of the research that they do to find something to complain about against anybody, you can see that this is earthy, natural, it's demonic, and where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder and every evil thing. I want something. What am I going to do to get it? Whatever it takes. Absolutely whatever it takes. And so where you see that, there is disorder and every evil thing. And what you see in a lot of our government today is the death of civility. The end of being able to disagree without being disagreeable, or the idea of exacting some sort of revenge against the party that used to be in power and now has fallen out of power. And that is described by these verses from James. Does not brag. The word for bragging appears only here in the New Testament. It has a meaning of using conceit in our communication. Okay? And so it's the glorification of the person who's speaking. Bragging is essentially the building up of self. Look at me. See how great I am. Don't you wish you could be like me? Don't you all wish you could be a short man, nearsighted, and losing his hair? Raise your hands. No takers. No takers. It's not possible to glorify God while bragging, because the person who seeks God realizes the glory and majesty of God. He must increase. I must decrease. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou dost take thought of him? And the son of man that thou dost care for him? As you know, accident that this appears, the Corinthians had problems in this regard. They wanted attention. They wanted public gifts, the more showy gifts. They wanted to speak in tongues. They want every eye to look at them. The limelight. This is the glorification of pride and the glorification of self rather than the glorification of God. Love does not brag. Finally, love is not arrogant. There are a good many people in this world who are arrogant. We've all known some of them. In general, they're not likable people. And this particular quality has no place in the church, none whatsoever. The Corinthians had some famous teachers like Paul or Apollos, Peter. They knew doctrine, and they had also received gifts from the Holy Spirit. And they also thought they had progressed so far in Christian liberty that they could overlook sin in the midst of the church. Paul says, what? You've got somebody that's doing things that aren't even permitted or frowned upon in the pagan society around you? You're worse than they are? And he said, you haven't mourned. What's the matter with you? Bragging is a communication to others of how great you are. The braggart's trying to impress the hearers. Arrogance is different, okay? Bragging is me saying, oh, I'm great, but I might be really not believing it in my own mind. I might be making up some stories. Braggarts are often liars as well, make up stories to make themselves look good. So the one who brags might do it to build himself up because in reality he's not that impressed with himself. The arrogant person has no such self-doubt. He truly believes that he is the greatest. And so this belief then is manifested in his behavior. You know, the Bible says a good man out of a good heart brings forth good things. Likewise, the evil man, evil things. The Corinthians had issues, which, you know, Paul addressed earlier in his letter. He uses himself and Apollos as examples. He says, I planted, Apollos watered. God is causing the growth. We're servants. We're working in the same field. But guess what? We don't own the field. We're like agricultural laborers. We're servants. In chapter 4, and starting in verse 6, Paul tells him, nobody should become arrogant on behalf of one against the other. He reminds them, the things that they have are all received. So there's no reason to boast. They're enjoying the gifts God has given them. Okay, they're comfortable while Paul is out struggling and facing daily trials. He said, "Boy, you think you're kings. I wish I could come and reign with you. I'm out here doing all this work." And so we need to remember at the end of the day that if we set out to practice Christian love, it's an intentional thing, okay? It's not necessarily spontaneous. Love can be work. Love can be hard work. So love is patient. We don't grow weary in well-doing. Love is kind, Okay. We don't give that slap up alongside the head, even if someone richly deserves it. Love is not jealous. It means we're content with what we have. We don't have the evil eye or the envious eye looking at that other person or wishing them ill because we don't have what they have. It doesn't brag. It doesn't say, look at me, how great I am. Don't you wish you could be me? I tried that. There was no takers this morning. And it's not arrogant. Okay, you don't go around with the attitude, you know, I'm better than anybody, and that means I can treat other people badly because of who I am. Not true. Not true. And so next week, week after next, actually, we have a guest speaker next week. I'm going to sit around and gather dust next week. So next after that, we're going to talk about verse 5. Does not act unbecomingly, does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered. That's a lot of components in the definition of Christian love. I hope we all understand it by the time we get through the chapter. We'll have our closing hymn now.